Thank you.
Good cat's got me.
He's a butter picker.
Oh, I called driver that time, I think.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is May 15th, 2013. First item on the agenda is a public hearing on Senate Bill 46. Ms. Braun.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 46 shortens the time period to bring a lawsuit against design professional from 10 years to 6 years for large commercial structures. There's no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Mayer, Stan Austin, David Evans, it looks like Leonard Lauder. There's room. Please go ahead, Danny Order, just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Stan Austin. I'm here on behalf of David Evans Associates and ACEC.
Okay. My name is Jeff Meyer with Meyer Group Architects, representing the AIA.
My name is Leonard Lauder, president of AIA Oregon, and representing the AIA as well.
Okay, thank you, sir. And restate your name when you start your testimony, please.
As I mentioned before, my name is Jeff Meyer. I'm the founder and president of Meyer Group Architects. We are located at 620 Southwest 5th Avenue, Suite 500 in Portland, Oregon. I'm a registered Oregon architect. I'm also a registered architect in 8 other states, all in the West. I've been practicing architecture here in Oregon for the past 21 years, and I care very much about the quality of professional design services that my company and I provide to our clients. I also take my duty and responsibility as an Oregon registered architect to protect public health, safety, and welfare very seriously. Unfortunately, over the past few years, I have seen a significant increase in the amount of third-party and construction defect claims that are being made against registered architects in Oregon. In fact, prior to 2005, I had never even heard of a third-party claim or knew what a third-party claim was. But over the past 8 years alone, Meyer Group Architects and I have dealt with 8 separate third-party claims that have been brought against us. And none of these claims have been brought against us by a client of ours. Every single claim has been brought against us by a third party that we've never done business with and we have never even met before. And while we've been very successful at defending every single claim that has been brought against us, and we've never been adjudged liable for any wrongdoing, professional negligence, willful misconduct, or anything, these claims are extremely emotionally difficult to deal with. They're very expensive for us to deal with. They're very time-consuming. And in my opinion and belief, they're simply not fair, reasonable, or just. As a result of the amount of claims that I have seen, I was part of an original group that was formed to study this problem. And that group consisted of insurance representatives, lawyers, architects, engineers, and we all worked at trying to study the problem and see what we could do to help our industry. As many of you know, architects and engineers have been very severely hit by the Great Recession. At one time, we had upwards of a 40% unemployment rate in our field. And while we are seeing some stability coming back to our industry, it's been very, very difficult for many architects and engineers to simply make ends meet. Basically, for your information, in my opinion, what I've seen is these third-party claims work in a certain manner. And the way it works is as follows. When a project is developed and sold by an owner or a real estate developer here in Oregon, they are required by law to hire a registered Oregon architect or an engineer and a licensed general contractor to build the project. Once a project is complete, the owner can then sell the project as a real estate asset in an as-is condition through a purchase and sale agreement with the new buyer. Through that agreement, an owner can basically indemnify themselves and absolve themselves for almost all liability associated with that project. But unfortunately, since the architect has a duty under Oregon law to protect the public health, safety, and welfare of the general public, the architect's potential liability with the project does not go away with the owner's sale of the project. And therefore, due to the lack of contractual privity in this state that has been decided by the circuit courts over the last 40 years, the architect can be held liable to the new owner for design and construction decisions that were rendered on behalf of or directly by the original owner, whether the architect endorsed those decisions or not. And since the current statute of repose in Oregon for general contractors is 6 years, as was changed back in 2009 by the legislature, and it's not 10 years as it is still currently for Oregon Registered Architects, the architects are exposed to 4 additional years of professional liability and risk for the actual construction of the building rather than the general contractor that actually built it. In my opinion, these 4 years are the most critical in the life of a building. And that's because many times deferred building maintenance and general building negligence can cause serious moisture intrusions, structural defects, and various other problems within a structure that occur around 7 to 8 years. So in other words, if people aren't taking care of their buildings as we would all take care of our homes, then the buildings eventually do have problems because buildings cannot last forever without maintenance and care. So unfortunately, the resulting problems that are caused are usually characterized by plaintiff attorneys as construction defects, which in my experience they usually are not. But since the architect is the only one of the 3 primary project team members of the owner, the architect, and the general contractor, or they say in my industry, the 3 legs of the stool, that has a statute of repose long enough for them to be exposed to these problems, they're the ones that get sued. Furthermore, even though architects are not licensed to build buildings or provide any sort of construction services under Oregon law, nor are they experts in construction techniques, procedures, means, or methods, registered architects are frequently sued for negligence associated with not stopping a building owner or general contractor from cutting corners or deviating from the design intent that the architect has expressed in its construction documents and specifications. Therefore, even when an Oregon registered architect like myself identifies problems in the field and sees that there may be a significant problem during construction that I may believe in my professional opinion may negatively impact the public health, safety, and welfare, there isn't much I can really do as an Oregon registered architect. What I can do, and I'm required by law to do, is inform the governing jurisdiction having authority over the project and the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. And even then, the architect will still have the immense displeasure of having to defend themselves in a subsequent lawsuit if there are things that go wrong. I can talk about many, many examples where I've seen that exact thing happen. I've seen examples where architects have been relieved completely indemnified and being completely indemnified from all construction phase duties and administration duties, still having to defend themselves, still having to pay very large deductibles. My deductible for every single claim that I see, whether fact or fiction, is $35,000. My company spends approximately $100,000 a year in legal fees tied directly to third-party claims against us, again, by people we've never even met, we've never provided services for. Therefore, in my opinion, I believe that this Senate Bill 46 should be passed, and I believe that my fellow citizens here in Oregon care very much about right and wrong and fairness. And I also believe that when there's a gross discrepancy in the state statutes regarding something like the current statute proposed for registered architects and general contractors, unfortunately, there will always be people who are more than willing to take advantage of it, which is exactly what we have seen over the past few years. It is for these reasons and for my continued passion for improving the practice of architecture here in Oregon that I'm here today. And again, I'm here to support the passage of Senate Bill 46. Thank you, and I'd be willing to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there any questions right now? Please go ahead. Whoever.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker and committee members. Thanks for allowing me to testify today. My name is Stan Austin. I'm testifying in favor of 46A. I'm on behalf of ACEC and David Evans and Associates, who I represent. I've been an attorney in Oregon for 18 years, something like that. I've been litigator, mediator, arbitrator, but primarily what I do or what I've done in the past is represent design professionals. And I'm going to be brief today with respect to this because, frankly, it's a pretty simple issue. We're simply asking that the statute of repose be consistently applied to design professionals as it is to contractors. Two points I want to bring up regarding the statute of repose, or at least one important point, and that is that in dealing with these lawsuits over the years, I've had several cases where a lawsuit's brought 8-9 years after the services are provided. And with, I don't know about other industries, but within engineers, they move around a lot. They move from company to company. And it's been, I've had cases where I couldn't find the people that did the work. I've had cases where I couldn't find the documents, or, you know, it, that long after the fact, it really creates a problem. You get past 6, 7, 8 years, it really creates a problem for the engineers, puts them in a very difficult position to try to defend a claim. And so, all I'm asking is for fairness. And, you know, when I looked at the statute and saw that the contractors were 6-year statute of repose, I was kind of racking my brain trying to think, well, why would they treat design professionals different? I still haven't come up with a good reason. I don't think there is a good reason why you would treat the design professional different than the contractor. And so if you're going to have a 6-year statute of repose for contractors, I would certainly advocate that it should be consistently applied and should be also 6 years for design professionals. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you.
As mentioned earlier, I'm Leonard Lauder, president of AIA Oregon, and I'm also a principal in Studio 3 Architecture here in Salem, located at 222 Commercial. And I'm going to be very brief. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 46A, and I believe that it is a question of fairness, that the statute of repose be identical for both architects and for the construction industry as a whole, in order for us to be able to manage the risk that is associated with ongoing work, and to share that risk beyond ourselves to new owners, et cetera, who ultimately become responsible for their own buildings, for maintenance, et cetera.
Thank you. Are there any questions, panel? Our committee. Thank you very much. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just comments more than questions. First of all, I don't think it will surprise anybody on this committee that I respectfully disagree with you. I just have a different perspective, but I do appreciate your coming in. And you, sir, who testified first, I can't recall your name, but...
Jeff Meyer.
Allow me to say I thought your remarks were particularly eloquent, so thank you for sharing them with me. And I do honor your experience. I think that a different perspective is one of somebody who purchases a building, it's 7, 6, 7, 8 years later, because of the statute of alter imposed, simply does not have a day in court. I'm not saying that they're necessarily going to win, but literally can't even have their day in court if there really is legitimate negligence. Now, so anyway, that's just, I think that just goes against everything inside of me, and depriving them of their day in court. However, I want to acknowledge that I think the, I guess, disparate statute and alter pose is not appropriate. There's no reason why you should be subject to a different statute and alter pose than some of your colleagues. However, I respectfully say I have a totally different take. I would prefer to raise theirs from 6 years to 10 years. I think that's a better deal. And Mr. Chair, to the extent the relating clause allows, I'm going to plan to pursue an amendment to that effect. I know that's not what you wanted to hear. Again, no offense. I just have a different perspective. I'll stop there, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you, panel. We don't have the paperwork ready, so we couldn't move it today anyway, but we'll certainly look forward and really appreciate your testimony on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 46A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 610. Call Mr. June Depp and Randy Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 610A conforms state laws with the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act, limits assistance animal definition to dogs and miniature horses, and authorizes expansion of definition by Bureau of Labor and Industries. Preserves the expansion of Oregon law to include animals in training, covers all types of disability, including mental health, as transportation to a public accommodation statute, consolidates statutes regarding assistance animal, declares emergency effective on passage. It has an A4 amendment that should be on your desk today, and that is an amendment that was asked for by the zoo, and it asks that place of public accommodation or access to state government services can impose the legitimate requirements necessary for the safe operation of services, programs, or activities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Judith. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon, and I'm happy to be talking with you about Senate Bill 610. This is an issue that came to our attention through the efforts of Senator Cruz and Senator Shields because of some problems that we have in our state statutes regarding service animals. The general overview of this area in state law is that of course the field of the Americans with Disabilities Act and service animals as used by people with disabilities as a means to interact with their communities as essentially what we call an assistive device that is governed by federal law, and the federal law generally applies across the board to all states and territories. And state law may add additional protections for people with disabilities over and above the federal law, but cannot go below that floor, if you will. Now, Oregon has had its own laws in this area for many years, but they are not consistent with the ADA in a variety of ways, but state law has provided some additional protections for people that are not in the federal law. And so the effort here really was to bring all of those factors together, to try to bring state law into conformance with federal law so that it was understandable, that it was in our disability civil rights statutes, and that the few instances in which state law provides some additional protections for folks with disabilities are not lost in that transfer. That was the challenge before us. We believe that after numerous meetings and discussions that we were able to get there. And I see Senator Cruz here, so I'd be happy to step aside.
Thank you very much. Senator Cruz, you want to come up and grab a chair? How you been?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, and I'm not sure what has been covered.
Just generally.
Okay. Interesting history on this. It was 2 years ago that I was approached by the Blind Veterans Association, who had some issues with the fact that it was possible in Oregon to purchase what was called a service animal that wasn't really a trained animal. And they said that was a problem needed to be addressed. So I drafted legislation 2 years ago that went nowhere, because I'm such a powerful person in this process. We took a slightly different approach this time because there were other issues that were involved. For example, we had heard from some retail establishments that the Oregon Department of Agriculture was requiring them to post notices, which, because by federal definition, a service animal is a dog or a small horse. And so they were, and I never have understood the small horse part, but I'm willing to accept that. The Department of Ag was requiring them to post these notices as to what were allowed inside the establishments, but what they discovered was for them to do that, to comply with federal ADA, would be in violation of state law. And so they weren't doing it. So we kind of had all of these things kind of circling around each other. So we created a work group, which included a couple folks that are sitting behind us here, and tried to figure out how to tackle this. Now, and all of these issues have been addressed in the bill. Now, I have heard from the Blind Veteran Association that since we passed the bill, that they're somewhat unhappy with the way we proceeded with this, because I think they were wanting to see some actual penalties and sanctions involved for those people who were doing this unfair practice. But it was our decision as a work group that sometimes it's better to try to change a culture and change a knowledge base without applying penalties, and see how well that works, and then as a last resort we could put sanctions in place. I mean, for example, we could have gone, there is a national registry for service animals, and we could have gone that route, but that would create a whole lot more bureaucracy and a whole lot more paperwork for the people that actually have service animals, and we didn't want to do that. So what I have communicated back to the people who I started this with was, sometimes you have to have a little bit of patience, and that we think this is an incredibly good first step, and it's all voluntary at this point in time, and what we will determine over the course of time is if the voluntary measures aren't working, we can do something more drastic. But we are hoping that this bill, the provisions that we have in this are actually going to serve the purpose that we are hoping for. And quite honestly, we needed to have some protection for business owners. For example, I've had anecdotal stories about people who would bring a snake into a restaurant with them and say it was their service animal, and I have yet to figure out how a snake can be a service animal. And this would allow a business to have the ability to say, no, you can't bring your snake. Now, there is one other side issue in this, and that is a new category called comfort animals, and which is different from service animals. We chose not to tackle that issue in this bill. But what we did, because is Boley actually does a lot of work with ADA, and correct? And so what we did was we assigned to Boley the ability to look into the issue of comfort animals and to make some determinations based on that. And an example I will use would be a person with PTSD, potentially, who has real issues with people invading their personal space. A dog can be trained to protect their personal space so they don't have the violent reactions. I would also suggest that maybe for some people, being able to hold a little kitty might be a comfort thing. But that's not where we started out with this. This was an issue that came up during the course of our work groups, and we thought, I said, this is kind of a new field to a large degree, and so those decisions will rest with Boley at this point in time. So we think we've basically covered all bases we need to. We have clear definitions now of what a service animal is, and we think we have the provisions in place that are going to discourage people from trying to sell a dog as a service animal that is not a service animal, and the ability to modify things in the future will rest with Boley. So we think we've got everything in the right place.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Senator Cruz? Representative Krieger?
How often I get to question my senator. I think this is the first time in 13 years, in fact. The issue of sanitation, I know we weren't talking about that, but you put dogs, horses in schools and hospitals, are they required to have any type of sanitation devices attached to these animals when they're in these type of facilities?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Krieger, the one thing about dogs is they're trainable, and I have had dogs in my life, and they knew that going in the house was a no-no. Okay, and which is one of the problems we're seeing with people is bringing their dogs into a grocery store on a leash, and they will do their business wherever they need to. But that's part of the training of a service animal is they know where and when and so they're able to maintain themselves. Accidents will happen on a very, but it would be a very rare occasion because we're dealing with a trained animal.
And if I may, good afternoon, committee. For the record, Elizabeth Cushwa with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Representative Krieger, in the bill, you'll notice that the public accommodations law allows for an animal to be removed from an area if it is not housebroken or if it's out of control and it's the effective action isn't taken to control the animal. So I think in terms of that thing, the animal may be removed if it is not well-behaved.
Thank you.
As long as I'm here, I'll keep going for a minute. Thanks so much. I'd like to especially thank Senator Cruz, Senator Shields, also had a bill for one of his constituents, which we managed to incorporate into this bill, which included assistance animals in training. Mm-hmm. An animal can't be expected to go anywhere if it hasn't been trained to do so, and so that has been incorporated into this bill along with their trainers. I'd like to especially thank DRO and George Okulich for pulling all of these disparate groups together and coming up with a solution that we feel is most closely mirrors the Americans with Disabilities Act. One additional piece that you'll notice in the A4 amendment is on page 2 of your A4 amendments. Thank you so much. We are eliminating some older statutes that have been folded into 659A, so that's what that eliminated. Those eliminations are their deletions because all of those statutes have been incorporated in 659A and were conforming, so I didn't want that to confuse the committee when it had to deal with housing. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, though my kids prefer to think of me as the lobbyist for the Oregon Zoo. And I am, in fact, that. The Oregon Zoo is owned and operated by Metro. It's a project of Metro, and I'm here today on behalf of the zoo. As this bill began to move in the Senate, we began some conversations with Senator Cruz and with DRO and Boley. With the intent of clarifying addressing concerns that we have about the potential interaction of zoo animals with assistance animals. We've had a couple of incidents over the years, and in order to protect the safety of the animals and the safety of the public, we just wanted to make sure that the legislation didn't cause us a big concern. We had some pretty fruitful conversations, and where we landed was with the amendment languages before you today, specifically lines 4 through 14 of the dash A4 amendment. That's the only part that relates to the zoo. The intent of this language is to carry forward some provisions in federal regulation as faithfully as possible and to put them in the context of this legislation to basically give a place of public accommodation like the zoo the ability to impose legitimate safety requirements that are necessary to protect safety. And so we have agreed on this language. We support this legislation in its current form, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Tucker.
I guess there's one other thing I'd add about the horses, which is not my business and not why I'm here today, but I was informed by Boley's attorney that has to do with a religious issue with certain religions that don't look favorably upon dogs. So, just, in case you're interested.
Well, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would suggest also that horses are relatively intelligent animals too and can be trained. But we are talking about mini horses, basically. We aren't talking about horses that run in the Kentucky Derby. And I should also say for the record that I support the amendment in front of you.
Okay. Thank you very much, panel. And on this bill as well, we do not have the paperwork to move it forward. So we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 610 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 476A. Okay. Dave Honeycutt. Is it David Ashton? Can't. I'm not sure if that's right. And Palmer Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 476A requires a 30-day notice and opportunity to comment to parties of prospective purchaser agreement who have agreed to clean up a contaminated property before the before the Department of Environmental Quality enters into a consent judgment concerning the contaminated property. Allows party to intervene before entry of a consent judgment. Allows court approval of agreement after intervention only upon finding the agreement is fair, reasonable, and consistent with provisions of removal or remediation action statutes, and that any contribution protections are supported by substantial evidence as being in the public's interest. Applies prospectively, declares emergency, effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, in support of SB 476. There will be a quiz on that explanation immediately following this. This is a kind of an interesting area of the law, and it's certainly far afield from the bill that you just heard. What we're dealing with here are cleanup of polluted sites. The state, a couple of decades back, the legislature adopted a policy to whereby the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, has the ability to enter into what are called prospective purchaser agreements with private companies to clean up contaminated sites. Prospective purchase agreement is essentially a contract between the department and the company to clean up the site. The company typically that enters into the prospective purchaser agreement typically buys the property at a reduced price, performs the work that's required by the contract, and then can turn around and develop the site. So it's an important public purpose, and it serves a couple of significant public needs. Number one, you clean up the sites at the expense of the private private market, and at the same time you get a piece of property that can then be developed and used in accordance with whatever the land use regulations are at the on the property. So it serves dual purposes and is a good program, one that we are very much in support of. The problem that we ran into as a result of a particular cleanup of a site in Sherwood, that was an old tannery site, is that it's possible, at least prior to the passage of what we hope is the eventual passage of this bill, that the prospective purchaser holder, the holder of one of these agreements, may be left out of the negotiations for the cleanup of the property. Under the current law, when the holder of a prospective purchaser agreement cleans up the site, they have the ability to go back in time, back through the chain of title, and if they can find the owner of the property at the time that the activities that resulted in the pollution occurring, if they can find that party, and if that party is still financially feasible, then they can seek a contribution for the amount of money that they spend in cleaning up the site. So essentially, if I sign a contract with DEQ, go out and clean up a polluted site, and can go back in the chain of title and find the owner of the property at the time that the activities that led to the pollution were occurring, I have the ability to go to seek contribution from that party for the cost that I just expended in cleaning up the site. What the problem that we had with this tannery case is that we had that essential fact pattern. We had a party to a prospective purchaser agreement go out and spend approximately $1.3 million in cleaning up an old tannery site. I don't know how many of you know anything about tanning hides, but it's not the most environmentally friendly method of business. They use a metal called chromium to tan the hides. And if the hides don't tan properly, then they become useless. And fortunately, this particular property at Sherwood had been used as a tannery for almost six decades, and when the hides didn't tan properly, the company would dig a pit in the back of the property and throw the hides into the back of the property. So needless to say, this was not a particularly clean site. It was somewhat toxic. Our guy, there was a private company that entered into a prospective purchaser agreement to clean up the site. They spent $1.3 million in cleaning up the site. as part of a global settlement negotiations, the party to the party that was owned the property at the time that the pollution was occurring was discovered, and the litigation ensued as part of the settlement negotiations that led up to a consent judgment. The company that did the cleanup work was left out of those negotiations, and a settlement was entered into between the department and the primary responsible party, with the company that paid $1.3 million to clean up the site being left out of that. And so what this bill does is a couple things. Number one, ensure that the holder of a PPA, the company that's cleaning up the site, gets a seat at the table when there are negotiations that are occurring that lead up to the entry of a consent judgment by the trial court. That's number one. That's the first thing that this bill does. The second thing that the bill does is it gives the circuit court, the trial court, some clear guidelines when reviewing a settlement agreement prior to entering the consent judgment. So it performs two important functions. And it's an attempt to ensure that the PPA holders get a seat at the table and are treated fairly and have a remedy should the settlement negotiations not go in accordance with their with what they were hoping that they would do. This bill is needed to keep that important public policy of getting private companies to clean up polluted sites. It saves the state's money and it saves the state money and converts properties to back into a usable form. Without this legislation, it will be hard, I believe, for the department to find property owners to find companies, private companies, who are willing to enter into these prospective purchaser agreements. So we very much support the amendments. We have a bit of legislative history that I'm working on right now with Mr. Mason and the department. So with the chair's blessing, if this bill comes back into work session, which we hope it will, Mr. Mason and I would like to proffer some additional legislative history if the chair opens a work session on this. The bill, by the way, was originally Senate Bill 680. It was amended into 476 through a gut and stuff because the agreement that we entered that we worked up with DEQ didn't fit the relating clause of the bill. So it comes to you as Senate Bill 476. It came off the Senate floor unanimously.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Ashton. I'm Assistant General Counsel with the Port of Portland, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 476A. I am an Assistant General Counsel who has extensive experience with dealing with contamination site cleanups and cost recovery actions. I've done a lot of legal work on brownfields redevelopment matters and have been working with the parties on this particular matter. I'm here to testify to clarify for the record certain things that this bill is not intended to do. First of all, this bill is not intended to affect prospective purchase agreement holders' rights to cost recovery under ORS 476, 255, subsection 1. Those cost recovery rights exist because they are a person who incurs remedial action costs attributable to or in connection with a contamination site. Secondly, this bill is not intended to affect the contribution liability protection shield that is available under DEQ settlements under ORS 465.325, subsection 6. And then finally, this bill is not intended to create a new remedy for existing prospective purchase agreement holders who may have a pending court challenge to an ORS 465.325 settlement agreement. The prospective purchase agreement program is a wonderful program that allows innocent parties to clean up sites incidental to getting them redeveloped. And so we urge you to support this particular bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. or good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. I want to echo the comments of these two gentlemen. We are here in support of this bill. And I do want to emphasize that settlement agreements are very important to the department because that's the primary way in which we clean up contaminated properties. DEQ, the state, more generally, does not have much money to go about and clean up contaminated properties. We primarily work with businesses and owners and operators of sites to address cleanup through a settlement where they get a release from liability from the state of Oregon, and in exchange for that, they provide the remedial dollars that we use to clean up the properties. This piece of legislation is important, and I may have a slightly different take than Mr. Honeycutt, but I am on the same page with him in that it's very important legislation, in that a prospective purchaser holder has a right of contribution under the existing law. And there would be a concern that they may never be able to exercise that right of contribution, in which they would be able to go and seek remedial dollars from other responsible parties were it that the money that's available, the assets that are available, were taken up under a separate settlement. And this is a statute, a bill, that's intended to try to resolve that problem by providing notice in advance to the PPA holder that there are ongoing discussions between the department and other entities to resolve the other entity's liability and provide dollars for cleanup. And were the PPA holder to feel like they are in a place where they didn't get treated appropriately or they still have additional concerns, as Mr. Honeycutt alluded, we've now given more guidance to the trial court how to more fairly evaluate the whatever claims the prospective purchaser holder may have around that global settlement. So I do think that it's very good public policy going forward that somebody who has existing right under statute have the opportunity to fully realize that right of statute, and this is what this bill does. I would say, as Mr. Honeycutt indicated, that this bill is different than an earlier version, and is different in a couple of key ways. One is it's not retroactive. That was an initial concern of ours about the original bill. It did not seem to us to be good public policy where a legislative enactment might upend settlements that were reached by parties in good faith. That issue has been taken off the table. There was another issue in an earlier version of the bill that also gave us concern, and that was under existing law, parties who settle with DEQ can get what is called contribution protection. In other words, they have liability protection from other entities for this their contribution claims. And that's a very powerful incentive the department offers to parties to come and sit with us, settle their liability, and provide the dollars we need for remedial action. Part of the inducement for that is this contribution protection. And earlier versions of this legislation would have pierced that contribution protection. I'm happy to say that's not the case with this legislation, and that's a credit to all the parties involved in trying to remove those two issues, the retroactivity and the contribution protection from the bill. And I think what we have here is a very good process where the department gives advance notice to PPA holders that a settlement discussion that may affect their interest is in fact happening and that they have the opportunity to fully participate in that. So, and I'll stop and take any questions.
Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. John Ledger, Monty Cobb, and Patrick Lucas.
John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'll be brief. We were one of the parties involved in the negotiations on this bill. We probably represent the largest number of entities that are involved in cleanup, not just doing the cleanup themselves, but attorneys, environmental attorneys, consultants, people who own labs, general contractors. Our primary goals with this process were to make sure that the existing process remained fair
and remains something that businesses can use to encourage cleanups. This is a very good program. It does that. And also to make sure there was no violence done to existing agreements, and this bill accomplishes both those goals. This is a very good program. You don't see a lot of changes to cleanup law because there's just so much liability associated with it and so much money and so much risk. People are generally afraid to tweak words, and this is one of the reasons this took a while. It went through, I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill. I just looked at the record. It went through the Senate without a single no vote. There were four people that objected to the bill vociferously in the Senate, not knowing that it was a gut and stuff. So they testified on a bill that established environmental impact statement, so that wasn't too damaging. But this is a good bill, and it's something we'd like to see passed, and I think everyone did good work on it.
Thank you.
My name is Monty Cobb. I'm an attorney. I represent Pacific 3, which is a business owned by Patrick Lucas, who is to my left. We have a case pending that really was the impetus for this bill. Mr. Lucas had and his business had performed a prospective purchaser agreement, and he can give you more details about what happened to him. But the DEQ then settled the case with the potentially responsible prior owners of the property, and then argued that the protection afforded by the contribution protection eliminated his right to recover from the potentially responsible parties, essentially sticking him with the $1.3 million that he had spent to clean up the property. That is one problem, and he can talk about it later, that's addressed by this bill. The second problem that we found was when the case got to court to try, Mr. Lucas's prior attorneys tried to object to the entry of the consent judgment that would have cut off his right, or arguably cut off his right to recover. There are no procedures in 465.325, so the court didn't know what standards to apply. If you read it literally, it was actually possible to read 325 as not allowing any review by a circuit court. The court had difficulty resolving those issues, and they're now before the Court of Appeals. So this bill addresses that by telling the courts what standards to apply to determine whether a consent judgment is fair, and also that there is to be a meaningful review and not just a rubber stamp by the circuit court. And if the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you.
I didn't plan on testifying. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Does this gentleman tell us his name?
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Patrick Lucas.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 476A and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 476A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves Senate Bill 476A to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Honeycutt has something he wants to put on the record.
Okay. Mr. Honeycutt, did you want to put something on the record first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Mr. Mason and I are currently working through some additional language that we'd like to present as legislative history, just a little further explanation of this bill. So we would hope the chair would indulge us, give us a couple of days to do that, and then before bringing the case or before bringing the bill up for work session.
So I submit that the court has suggested that if we do want to put something into the legislative history, the floor, the carrier saying so on the floor is the most valuable place to insert that. That's what they've told us.
That's true.
Would that work for you if we have a carrier?
I can't see behind me. I don't know what Mr. Mason is doing.
We'll work with that, yeah.
Fine.
I think Representative Mason is correct. It's the best list of history there is.
Okay, we will do that. We'll work with you on that. Thank you.
So there's a motion before the committee to move Senate Bill 476A to the fourth and do pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry the bill?
Bailey, maybe? Is Bailey familiar with this? Jules?
Representative Hicks.
Oh, I'll do it. Okay.
Representative, I'll do that. I'll work with
that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 592A. Wendy Johnson, Dr. Charles Martz, and Susan Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The committee, Senate Bill 592A, is from the Oregon Law Commission and revises the Uniform Trust Code. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My name is Charles Martz. I am past chair of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Estate Planning Administration, and I'm a member of the work group on the Oregon Law Commission that devised this bill. And the origin of this bill began about 3 years ago when the State Planning Committee elected to solicit comments from the practicing bar as to issues they had encountered with the Uniform Trust Code. It had been on the books at that point for several years, and the idea was to find out what the problems were and then develop a bill that would potentially correct those problems. The suggestions that we received from the practicing bar were pretty much within five groups of areas. The first was a beneficiary designation, and knowing who the beneficiaries are is one thing, but knowing who you have to contact for purposes of notice and court actions and agreements between beneficiaries and the trustee, participation in other trust matters and compliance, to whom notices are sent, it's a very difficult task to sort out who is required to be included. And when you think of a trust, I use the analogy of a layer cake. You have a top layer, which is the beneficiaries who are currently entitled to benefits. Beyond them, when that group and their rights to this trust terminate, you move to a second layer. And that second layer is identified in the statute. And then after that, if those beneficiaries, some of them don't survive, or there is yet another layer below them, you move into a category that is not defined beyond beneficiaries. And if you get into that category, then you're dealing with every possible beneficiary of a trust, which, depending on the circumstances, the length of time of the trust, could literally involve everybody down to the state of Oregon. In other words, that the whole trust would escheat to the state of Oregon for the lack of beneficiaries. And in between, you would have potentially heirs, representatives of various family members who you could not find, you couldn't identify, you had no addresses for. So we kept churning this process of who are the beneficiaries, what do they need to know what's going on, what does the trustee have to do to keep those people informed, and a confined group, or at least a defined group, is really what we needed to have. The second group was trustee issues, compensation of trustees, especially when there are multiple trustees. Are there multiple fees involved? Removal of a trustee. Who participates? What is the basis of removal? In other words, what are the foundations that you can claim that a trustee needs to be removed? The compliance issue, as I mentioned before, trustee has to send out an annual report. What does the report contain? To whom must it be given? What are the consequences of failure to provide that report? The certain sections of the current UTC were imported from the probate code. And if you're aware of the probate code, it is a shall we say, an ancient law by modern terms, and it has a lot of unique provisions in it. And when these provisions were then introduced into the UTC, the effort to harmonize the language and the context of those probate provisions were not completely perfect. And so many of the comments that we received were, this process here that is easy in probate just doesn't fit within the context of a trust. And so our effort here was to see, what were those problems? Where were those mismatches, and what can we do to correct them? The last part of this group was where the UTC was silent. And there were a number of places where we felt that the UTC could be improved. And whether it would be trustees seeking instructions from beneficiaries, whether it was how long does this trust last, if a trust is divided into several parts, do each of those parts take on a new existence, or were they part of the old trust? So we had these questions that we did not have answers for. And so new provisions were created for the UTC, which we believe will solve some of these problems. This is an overview, and Professor Gary, to my right here, will answer and discuss the specifics. But if you have any questions on this overview, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Great. I'm Susan Gary. I'm a law professor at the University of Oregon, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission. I was chair of the work group that developed this bill. You have electronically the work group report, and that will serve as the written testimony on this bill. I don't want to go through this section by section. I think Mr. Moritz has given us a good overview of the problems. The bill does address the problems that he has identified for you. I just want to highlight a couple of things. First is that the bill does contain definitions, two new definitions of beneficiaries to allow us to fine-tune the provisions on notification and also on modification. One of the things that this bill does is to improve the administration of trust law in Oregon. And it does that in a number of ways, but particularly in connection with notification and with modification. I think those are a couple of the important areas. Modification provisions in Oregon are particularly important, and we in Oregon are, I think, ahead of much of the rest of the country in providing for non-judicial settlement agreements so that trust administration, when problems surface years after the trust was created, the beneficiaries and the trustees can resolve the problems, modify the trust without going into court. But there were a number of questions that came up in connection with that, including who was supposed to be involved in that process. So with these new definitions, it should be easier to facilitate non-judicial settlement agreements with the important parties involved in that. We were very careful that the bill protected the interests of the beneficiaries, so we didn't want to cut the interests of beneficiaries who did need to play a role in this. One group of beneficiaries that we were concerned about were the charities. Charities are represented by the Attorney General, and there are a couple of provisions in the bill that clarify the role of the Attorney General with respect to Oregon charities in a couple of places where things just weren't clear. And I should add that a number of the provisions in the bill are truly technical amendments or clarifications. There are some more significant changes, so it's not purely a technical amendment bill, but some of the changes are of that order. In connection with modification, another thing that I wanted to note is the role of the trustee in connection with modification. One of the issues that surfaced was that the trustees expressed concern about whether they could be part of a modification proceeding that changed the trust at all, because trustees have duties, fiduciary duties to the trust, and they were worried that simply modifying a trust would be construed as a violation of their fiduciary duties. We clarify in the bill that will amend the statute, we clarify that the just participation in a modification agreement would not be a violation of the trustee's duties of obedience or loyalty. Obviously, the trustee would need to look at other provisions of the modification and make sure that the modification was in keeping with the settlor's original intent. But just the fact of modification wouldn't be considered an impediment. One of the new sections that's added, there are two new sections that will be added to the code by this bill, and one provides that or creates a process by which the trustee can give beneficiaries notice of a proposed action that the trustee proposes to undertake with sufficient time for sufficient time to object and with enough information so that the beneficiary will know whether the beneficiary would be interested in objecting to that proposed action. If the time elapses without objection, the trustee will be able to continue and undertake that proposed action without concern about some later liability. The provision limits the types of actions that can be undertaken using this process so that any major change to the trust or any major action with respect to the trust would require the usual notice and consent provisions that the trust code already requires. But for a number of things that the trustee would want to do, this new process should streamline things and make administration a little bit easier. So, overall, the purpose of the bill is to improve the efficiency of trust administration while still protecting the interests of the beneficiaries. The goal is to make trust law work better for the beneficiaries, for the trustees, and for the other people affected by the trust. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have. And we have an amendment that my colleague will explain.
Okay. Ms. Gray, Wendy.
Chair Parker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. The Uniform Trust Code was adopted during the 2005 session, and it was a work group from the State Bar. Then it became effective in 2006. So this is a cleanup bill of the existing trust code. The request this time came from the State Bar to assist with the cleanup bill, and we included the estate planning section was the main membership of our work group, but we included banks and the Department of Justice because so many of the issues involve charities, and the Department of Justice handles those issues when the beneficiary of a trust includes a charity. So we were able to have a larger work group than just the estate planning section. So that's sort of the context of where the bill came from. You do have before you the -A3 amendments, and those that amendment is not coming from the commission itself or the work group, but it was at the request of Representative Hicks and an attorney in Salem, Nathan Reitman. The commission's neutral on that amendment. We see it more as a technical or clarifying amendment. It would make a change on page 13 of the bill, which is amending section 18, which is ORS 130.655. That's the duty of loyalty section that applies to trustees. The beginning of that section in subsection 1, it says that a trustee is to administer the trust in the interests of the beneficiaries. That's the general standard for trustees. And then all the subparagraphs after that, getting down to number 7, which is the one that this amendment would change, there are specific rules on what acting in the best interest includes, since there's special rules. The amendment would make it clear that if the trust owns a corporation, that those same duties of loyalty apply in how you choose, elect or appoint your directors. And right now the language says if the trust is the sole owner of a corporation, they have this duty. The question that arose from the attorney in Salem was, what if the trust owns 95% of the corporation or something? And so by deleting the word sole, that same standard of acting in the best interest of the beneficiaries would apply. So the goal in that specific language is to make sure that when you own the trust as a corporation, the trust owns a corporation, that there's the duties that you have as in the corporate law world as well as the trust code. And the trust restatement goes into that issue, and there is a sliding scale, and at some point there can be a conflict. We're just clarifying that provision, again, at the request of Representative Hicks. I'll just add that this just, I want to thank the committee. This is the commission's last bill of the session in the House Judiciary Committee. But we've already agreed to take on the probate code. I thought it was interesting that Mr. Moritz noted that probate issues were in the trust code that were a mess. Well, funny he should mention that because that is the next project in this area. There's been a considerable interest from the bar as well as the public in improving the probate code, especially as it relates to small estates. And we've been asked to look at particularly Washington's model, which is a larger small estate affidavit procedure. So we'll be taking that on in the interim. But again, thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Johnson. Any questions? Yes.
Just a comment. Thanks all who worked on this. And once again, we're reminded if we didn't have a law commission, we would have to do this work. So be sure and fund them, Representative Williamson.
Okay, thank you very much. So we can't move on.
We could do the amendment now, right?
Yeah, we can do the amendment now.
We can move it in and then we can bring it back to pass it.
Yeah, I'll move it. Yeah.
Okay, open a work session on Senate Bill 592A.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash
three
amendment to Senate Bill 592.
Representative Garrett moves the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 592A. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
We'll move it
next Wednesday. We will bring this bill back next Wednesday to finish the work.
Next Monday.
Is he here?
Tomorrow. I'm here tomorrow.
Wednesday.
We are adjourned.